Thank you,
Nana, for the invitation. I'm afraid I'll be too long because I brought music, so I have to play a little bit faster than usual. Oasis. Okay.
So, a couple of
months ago, after performing at a jazz venue in Stuttgart, which I kind of demonstrated for, an older man came to the band stage and he said that he liked the tunes on our website, but it angered him that tonight we were performing what he said minaret music. So, jazz musicians often get weird feedback, but in 20 years of performance, I have never came across minaret music. Metaphor is never innocent, Jacques Derrida wrote it once. I realized that the old man had to refer to tunes that were based on the Phrygian scale. I'm giving a workshop now. Ionian, and then the Phrygian would just be another tone. And this happens during improvisation, you know. Despite the fact that this scale has been used in Western music for centuries, the single note has obviously created an oriental association. And if you add an uneven meter, I can see how the old man would see himself confronted with Islamization. So it starts like this. An influx of refugees, and it turns like into this. So this one that happened, and then it triggered something. So Wittgenstein wrote once that language always comes with a culture, and this applies sometimes to single notes as well, obviously. My point here is, of course, that this old man's slur in Stuttgart, where the anti-immigration AfD party is so successful, was no random event, but a more or less truth event, something real and revealing. A truth event always contains the trajectory of a possible future. In this case, I can envision a future law that prohibits the use of the Phrygian scale in Germany. And I can easily envision this man participating in a future war between Phrygians and Ionians. And if you think this is far-fetched or silly, I may remind you of Richard Wagner's book, Judaism in Music, from 1851. That contains all the necessary parameters of the Third Reich expressed solely in musical terms. Or take a visual example. One of the first post-war European anti-Islamization protests took place in an illustration for the cover of a Belgrade magazine in 1982. A well-known right-wing artist portrayed his nation of Serbs who are taking it to the street and protesting the Islamic infiltration of Serbian language. This is not about Oriental notes, but about letters that had migrated to Slav language via Ottoman occupation. True to the old man, we could call them minaret letters. Of course, back then in socialist Yugoslavia, the illustration was ridiculed and banned. However, 10 years later, it became realpolitik. You see, if only music existed in the world, the symbolic border regime could be reduced to a single note or letter. In other words, radical politics starts with the slightest of symbolic interventions long before violence and death occur, simply because violence and death are ubiquitous, are around us all the time. Since music is the most immediate art form, as Schopenhauer once put it, is most likely to allure people to fall for the identity trap. As a jazz musician, you look at scales and cultures in an egalitarian manner, very much similar to serial music, in which all musical parameters have equal rights. In other words, improvising is about a fundamental detachment of identity from the technique of expressing it. The political right, however, sees no difference between expression and identity. This is why nationalists like to think of themselves as direct representatives of the will of the people, and this is why they are imagining huge crowds of supporters where there are none. A Kulturkampf attitude completely ignores the universal musical structure that makes cultural distinctions possible in the first place. So in this context, improvisation as symbolic form structurally mirrors the phenomenon of migration by expanding the creative horizon and entangling the cultural, political, and economic relations. It is, so to speak, a phenomenon on the move that has concerned scholarship for a long time. And I'm glad to be surrounded by migration scholars, because I'm not a migration scholar. And I like to quote my colleagues here. As Kim Rigiel points out, it enables us to examine how notions of identity, community, and politics are negotiated in and through movement. It enables us to understand the contingency of citizenship itself. Brigitta Kustan notices similarly that migrating is a concrete challenge to our understanding of citizenship. The person on the journey is never the same in the end. Sandro Mezzata similarly speaks of, quote, the persistent turbulence, autonomy, stubbornness of migration, its ungovernable moments of freedom and excess. To me, these sentences sound could equally describe a free jazz album of the 60s. And I think it's not really, I just found out about it yesterday. The next conference will be about free music. It exactly addresses the issue, so it could have been one conference, actually. Also, think about it, that I would assume that 99% of publicly broadcasted music is non-improvised. So I don't want to romanticize migration, I only want to point out that the structural understanding of what improvisation means refers to the very questioning of the political substance of all identity regimes as such. This is already the migrating of symbolic forms alone that tells us a lot about the circumstances of cultural production, the creation of historical value, and the according national sentiments and policies. So, as an example, the 2003 documentary, Whose Is This Song?, traces the origins of a traditional folk melody across several countries of Southern East Europe, including Serbia, Bulgaria, Albania, Greece, Turkey, etc. Each of the locals interviewed in the film claim that the melody originates in their country. It turns out, however, that the melody has migrated so much that its origin is lost forever, and with it the national self-assertion. The song was first recorded in the USA in 1924 by klezmer clarinetist Naftule Brandwein. There are later recordings by Stella Lee and Eartha Kitt. Boney M's Rasputin features a similar melody, by the way. And there exists even a Bengali adaptation from the Indian poet Kazi Nazrul Islam. Yet, what does this example of cultural appropriation prove beyond the obvious? As I have shown in my previous work, many national narratives steal or adopt from each other, eagles and symbols and so on. This also applies to representative state symbols such as anthems. Haydn's motif for the Kaiserlied, for example, is loosely based on a Slavic folk song that makes up today's German national anthem. Israel's Hatikva is based on an Italian Renaissance motif, and Smetana appropriated for his famous orchestra piece, the motto, you know. Between 1871 and 1918, the Kaiserreich had used the British anthem, God Save the King, as the German anthem. Liechtenstein still used the British anthem. And extravagant former Rhodesia used Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode an die Freude as their anthem, and so on. A Western invention, the overwhelming majority of world anthems stick to the traditional marching rhythm with its typical 2/4 meter and independently of the cultural background. You could easily swap the Saudi Arabic anthem with the Austrian anthem or the South Korean anthem with the German anthem, and it would make no difference in terms of decorum. It would certainly hurt feelings, but there is nothing that could not be reappropriated in national terms. I cannot read this. Because to paraphrase Marx, not only workers, but also power has no homeland. The uniformity of national form neatly follows the uniformity of global capitalist symbolism, simply because the nation is a global container format of capital, if you will, or an ideal reflection of the real abstract equivalence of a commodity form. This means, for example, there's no comeback or backlash of nationalism because it never went away. And it means that you can read from the musical structure how much a symbolic form is indebted to a capital form. Not surprisingly, today's biggest pop hits, too, never use uneven meters, and harmonically they often accord to 18th century minuets, with cadences rarely exceeding tonic, subdominant, and dominant chords. Dominant chord instabilities are always resolved in the tonic. The sound needs to be affirmative, neatly packaged, and readily consumed without any resistance. Recent German attempts at turning patriotism into music also accord to this. Take the German anti-Islamic Pegida movement's anthem, for example, which has only one tonic and dominant chord transposition. Or take Nena's album Made in Germany, that follows all pop parameters of nation branding, a sales strategy that has become popular since the 2006 Football World Cup. Whether racist, xenophobic, or liberal attachment to the nation, many forms accord to what could be called pop nationalism, the use of popular culture for national display. Michael Billig has used the term banner nationalism to describe more broadly the daily material flaggings of ideology. Ideology is always material, of course. The question, what comes after nations, therefore must address this endemic nationalist structure, because its material manifestations are everywhere, as the commodity form is. I would assume that it is impossible to be really anti-system of any kind if you stick to the given vocabulary and given chords, so to speak. Musically speaking, any concert at an avant-garde jazz venue in Berlin is more radical and anti-Western than ISIS. There's a reason why the Jacobins unraveled the entire calendar system and introduced a secular religion, and why 20th century avant-gardists abolished representation. So, I'm following Sandro here. There's on one hand a reified uniformity of symbolic expressions, and on the other hand, incommensurable cultural differences that are permanently celebrated or fought out. This constellation is not as clear-cut, it creates a range of confusions. So, everything could have been so easy. Since 1983, the annus mirabilis of nationalism studies, we know what nations are and what they are not. Ernest Gellner provided a typology of nationalism inducing in nationalism thwarting situations. Anthony Smith focused on the mechanisms of bonding between members of a nation. Benedict Anderson focused on the social imagining of national identity in accord with the evolution of printing press capitalism. The Marxist scholar Eric Hobsbawm introduced a similarly popular concept with his analysis of how long-durée notions are, as a matter of fact, based on recent policy. As Ernest Renan put it once, getting its history wrong is part of being a nation. And this triggers also a Dussert's notion that ideology has somehow no history, it's always already there. However, it seems to me that not only getting the history wrong, but getting everything wrong is part of the ideological mapping of today, and this is what I would call the symbolic disorder or idiotism. Recently, for example, during the opening ceremony of the US Open, an official sang the German anthem, but used lyrics associated with Nazi anthem. In a display of defiance, the female German team countered with the official version of the anthem, a kind of Casablancian moment. After this incident, the organizer apologized, of course, and the German team was heralded by the press for symbolically withstanding revisionism, right-wing ideology, and so on. Of course, this completely misses the point. The tennis team did not take a stance against anything, but was simply trying to be correctly nationalistic. This is what, by the way, liberal capitalism critique looks like, too. People who claim to be anti-capitalist very often only want to be correctly capitalistic. The confusion about the scandal was enhanced in the aftermath. German player Andrea Petkovic, who had fled with her family from the Bosnian War in the 90s, exclaimed in all seriousness that the anthem mix-up was, quote, the worst thing that happened to me in my entire life. Ironically, she was bashed in right-wing forums.
Sie wurde in rechtsextremen Foren gebasht, da sie nicht das Recht hätte, diese Gefühle zu haben, dass sie eine Einwandererin, eine Migrantin sei. Also das heißt, sie war zwar integriert in Deutschland und meiner Meinung nach sogar zu integriert, aber die Rechten wollten, die soll nicht so ganz so patriotisch sein. Es muss eine Grenze sein zwischen echten Deutschen und Deutschen, die nicht echt deutsch sind. Also das heißt, ein ehemaliger bosnischer Flüchtling ist vor nationalistischen Kriegen geflohen und ein Jahrzehnt später wird sie dann verstrickt in nationalistischer Rhetorik und dann wird sie von deutschen Nationalisten auch noch kritisiert dafür, dass nur die deutschen Nationalisten bestimmen können, was wirklich ein nationalen Skandal darlegt. Oder Kreuzberg zum Beispiel, da gab es radikale Links oder Linksradikale, die haben ein Restaurant in amerikanischer Hand zerstört. Und da hieß dann der Slogan dreckige und sagte dreckige Ausländer raus. Also wir wollen stinkreiche Bonzen sollen raus. Also das heißt, eigentlich ist das ja eher eine rechte Propaganda. Das kenne ich ja selber aus meiner bayerischen Provinz. Halleluja. Denn nicht alle Flüchtlinge sind willkommen. Aber wenn man reich ist, dann heißt es, ja, raus mit dir. Das heißt, wenn sie kommen, dann müssen sie wenigstens arm sein. Ein armer Ausländer für die Linke. Damit die Deutschen, die ihnen helfen, sich gut fühlen können. Also mein springender Punkt ist, das sind nicht nur Einzelfälle, sondern die Kämpfe für die Rationalität werden irrational ausgekämpft, über die Wissenschaft hinweg. Ernest Laclau hat das in seinem Buch Populistische Riesen geschrieben. Die Verwerfungen, die in den sozialen Beziehungen verortet sind, sind tiefer als in der Vergangenheit. So die Kategorien werden immer, so sind die Kategorien der Vergangenheit einfach überholt. Laclau hat recht, aber das Ringen um neue Kategorien scheint unendlich und ist Teil des politischen Kampfes. Matthew Poole schaut sich dieses Theater des Diskurses an und das ist eine Regel der Regellosigkeit, gemäß der alles über alles behauptet werden kann, ohne einen Bedeutungsträger, nur wenn das dem eigenen Ego passt. Dieses neue Paradigma wird von Christopher Lasch als Kultur des Narzissmus bezeichnet. Zentrum etc. bezieht sich genereller auf Zonen der Unbestimmtheit, wo die faktischen Grenzen zwischen Wirtschaft, Politik und Kultur kontinuierlich überarbeitet und neu überarbeitet werden. Und das führt manchmal zu einer bestimmten Betriebsblindheit oder konzeptionellen Blindheit, welche Marx als Idiotismus des Bürgertums bezeichnet hat. Ein Jahrhundert später hat Heidegger Planetarismus als Idiotismus bezeichnet. Das hat er im Kontext mit dem planetarischen Übernahme der Technik und eine generelle Gleichgültigkeit der Identitätsbedeutungsträger gegenüber gesehen. Und Heidegger wurde praktisch einer der ersten Opfer seiner eigenen Idiotie. Aber es ist genau diese Gleichgültigkeit, von der die aktuelle Rechtsextreme profitieren. Sie vereinnahmen Feminismus, Säkularismus, sogar andere Rechte und gleichzeitig wird das wurde vor kurzem ein jakobinischer Artikel veröffentlicht und hier steht dann drin, dass das Ganze, dass die Rechts- und Linkspopulisten sich immer mehr annähern. Also es gibt riesige Todesfälle an den Grenzen und im Mittelmeerraum. Und es erscheint mir überraschend, wie viel des Migrationsdiskurses der letzten Jahre immer mehr symbolischer Natur wurde. In Ostdeutschland gibt es die Gebiete mit den stärksten Protesten gegen Einwanderer, mit den geringsten Einwanderungszahlen. Und dennoch scheint es so, als sei der deutsche Staat in Gefahr, wenn Busse in Dresden ankommen mit Flüchtlingen. Oder wenn ich meine phrygische Tonleiter oder freaking Tonleiter spiele. Das heißt, man muss das Ganze dialektisch verstehen. Die nationale Imagination braucht den anderen, braucht den Andersartigen, den Ausländer für die emotionale Erfüllung oder musikalisch gesprochen. Man braucht die orientalischen Noten, um auch noch etwas zu fühlen beim Zweivierteltakt und den alten Märschen. Also, was habe ich dem alten Mann gesagt, als er an mich herantrat und sagte, Mensch, Minarettmusik? Und ich habe gesagt, gern geschehen.